Ah, I think we have Vanessa. Are you there, Vanessa?
I'm here. I hope I'm here for a bit longer than last time.
Yeah. So do we. You can imagine. You hear my quavering voice trying to maintain. Now, Vanessa, I want you to confirm something. There was supposed to be a battle. I want to contextualize this White Helmet story, which, and 21st Century Wire has done the best work. There was going to be a dangerous confrontation, but cooler heads prevailed, and they began to negotiate one of these things we've seen in the past, which is they lay down their arms, they either reintegrate with the community, or they get on buses and go away to Idlib. Now, this time, though, some of them, and I guess that's my question to you, did some or all, did anybody get on buses and go to Idlib, or did they all go out through this Israeli, Jordanian, American, Canadian operation? And there's no question that these are jihadi terrorist elements in that area, right? The United States, Russia agree.
Yeah.
So please.
I think basically what has happened, I mean, obviously there is a degree of intelligence coming in as the hours pass. And yesterday I actually did an interview on Al Mayadeen channel with two guests, one from Damascus, a researcher from Damascus, and another one from Jordan. And what came out of that discussion and has been confirmed by a couple of other reports that I've seen today, particularly from a Syrian perspective, is that because my first question was when I saw the number of 800 white helmets, and when we bear in mind that in Eastern Ghouta and in East Aleppo, we had a very similar scenario in which UN agencies were requesting the special evacuation of the white helmet agents. In Eastern Ghouta, there was a number of 76 white helmets that was being bandied around by UN agencies, and there was a complaint put in by the permanent representative to the UN in New York for Syria, Dr. Al-Jafri, about the fact that the UN agencies were requesting a special evacuation for the white helmets with no regard for civilian life. And so to me, it's not particularly surprising that, as you said, with the closing in of the Syrian Arab Army, the large-scale surrender of the militant forces, who had, of course, also been abandoned by the United States. I mean, the United States very quickly, when this campaign set out, made the statement that it was not going to come to the aid of the militants that it had been backing in the south. But when I heard that there were 800 white helmets, I immediately became a little bit suspicious, because although the southern provinces are it's quite a big area, but as regards actual urban areas, it's not. It's largely open areas. So it made no sense to me, in contrast to, for example, Eastern Ghouta, which is a big area, but it's a largely sort of urbanized area, that there would be quite a big number of white helmets in Eastern Ghouta, but there were only 76. So then for there to be 800 in the southern provinces was a little bit stretching the possibilities. So then when I did this interview with Al Mayadeen, what I found out was that reports on the ground were saying that it was more than the 800 exceptional refugees, let's call them, that had transited into Israel at the behest of the US, the UK, in other words, the regime change coalition. There were numbers of around 3,000 that were believed to have been given special treatment by the Israelis to pass into Israel and then, in theory, to be transited to Jordan. But on that basis, we know that only 442 have arrived in Jordan. So the question arises:
Did somebody get off the bus?
Exactly. So the reports that are coming in are that there were a huge number of Gulf state militants and intelligence that exited via the Israeli border, from the UAE, from Qatar, from Saudi Arabia. that there may well have been NATO special forces. Now, again, you know, this isn't some kind of wild conspiracy theory, because we had very similar reports during the evacuations of East Aleppo after the liberation. And, of course, in Eastern Ghouta, we had very similar stories. And we were told, or I was told, by a number of civilians that I interviewed, both in East Aleppo and in Eastern Ghouta, that there were foreign coordinators on the ground who were communicating with their controllers and their handlers in the various countries that were funding the militant groups, but also within the UN. Particularly in Eastern Ghouta, there were foreign coordinators speaking directly to representatives within the UN, according to civilian testimony that I took after the liberation. And they described in great detail exactly who these coordinators were, what groups they worked with, how many there were. And in Eastern Ghouta, for the first time, I heard of there being foreign elements within the White Helmets themselves. We know that over 280, or rather 280 British passport holders left Eastern Ghouta, having been fighting with Nusra Front. They left on the evacuation buses for Idlib. So, you know, while this does seem to be sort of quite a wild theory, it's becoming more and more feasible when you compare it to previous liberations, that there are special forces that were given this special kind of extradition from areas. And of course, Phil, they wouldn't want to get on the buses to go to the north, because, of course, to do that, they would have to go through some sort of inspection of their papers, of their equipment, of their nationality. And the last thing they would want to do, of course, is to expose the number of, let's say, foreign fighters and mercenaries in among, you know, as the West loves to call them, the freedom fighters and the rebels in the south. So it would make sense also that Israel, that has been training and offering medical treatment to the militant factions, including ISIS, actually, on the border with Israel, would be doing its utmost to extricate those militants from any potential risk, and also the risk of them, let's say, giving any evidence or giving any information about Israel's role in the south.
We're speaking I'm sorry.
Yeah.
This is Vanessa Bealey and 21st Century Wire, and of course Vanessa Bealey you can find on Twitter. And Vanessa, the on this matter of Israel's role, they issued a statement where they said, of course, they're doing this on a humanitarian basis, and then there's a quote, and this is today's Globe and Mail, says, of course, Israel continues to maintain a non-intervention policy regarding the Syrian conflict. I've read reports that the Israelis actually have bombed Syria. There's no dispute about that, is there?
No, absolutely none. And I mean, what happens is that Israel, we saw as the Syrian Arab Army, before the full liberation campaign in Eastern Ghouta, when there were moments when the Syrian Arab Army were pushing back against the militant occupation in Eastern Ghouta, of course, Israel then would generally bomb the Mezzeh military base in Damascus. But now what we're seeing, when the Syrian Arab Army took the Tal al-Hara hill, which is sort of quite close, it's further to the west of the southern region towards the Israeli-occupied Golan territories, of course. And at that point, Israel bombed, I could be wrong, but I think it was north of Aleppo at that point. Forgive me if that's wrong, but they definitely did bomb at that point. And then, of course, when was it? 2 days ago, they attempted to bomb Mesyaf, which is an area to the west of Damascus. And I believe that there is a research center there, which is what apparently Israel was trying to target. So, I mean, yes, I mean, it's ridiculous for Israel to make the claim that it has a non-intervention policy in Syria, because it has consistently and systematically intervened. And let's not forget that when the UK, France and the US carried out an unlawful act of aggression against Syria after the now disproven Douma chemical attack, it was Israel that had been acting in a surveillance role prior to that attack. So, you know, and Israel has been consistently, as we said, aiding and abetting the militant factions in the south. It has been through a number of NGOs trying to sort of win hearts and minds in the south over to Israeli occupation. Mm-hmm. It has used the militant factions as sort of custodial guardians of the borders of the territory that it is illegally occupying in Syrian territory.
Yeah.
You know, so it's insane to say that this is, this entire project is not also closely linked, of course, to the Zionist project in the region.
Well, and it's Vanessa Bealey we're speaking to, and by the way, Vanessa has done a lot of on-site reporting, gone to Syria and does excellent reports. Vanessa, what I find frustrating, of course, in talking about all these things is the way they slip in language, which I bristle at. Mm-hmm. The Toronto Star today says that they speak at the White Helmets, and then they say, which are officially known as Syria Civil Defense. Well, that's not true, is it?
No.
You, following your writing, Syria does have a Syria Civil Defense founded in 1953. So isn't this impersonation? Isn't the West playing a dirty game here of trying to regime change the civil defense of Syria?
Well, yeah, and I mean, this has been one of the primary roles, of course, of the White Helmets, is basically to revise the history of the conflict, because, of course, you know, now what is being promoted by the media and by the government talking heads in the UK and in the US is the fact that, oh, well, we created the White Helmets to document the war crimes inside Syria. And yet, my point, of course, always is, but there is absolutely no documentation of the atrocities carried out by the terrorist groups with whom the White Helmets work very closely. I mean, they share the same buildings, they share the same ideology, they move with those armed groups whenever they move. In other words, they don't stay in areas that have been liberated to help the civilians that they claim to be serving. One of the roles of the White Helmets was to basically erase the real Syria civil defense from Western public perception. And as you rightly say, the White Helmets are not recognized by the International Civil Defense Organization.
I'd really like to underline that. They have no, I can't see any affiliation with an international body which could be called humanitarian, like the Red Crescent or the Red Cross. The only humanitarian groups they're affiliated with is the White House, the Foreign Office in England, and that's about it.
That's right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I mean, actually, when I interviewed in January of this year, I interviewed the director of the Syrian Arab Red Crescent. And of course, the Syrian Arab Red Crescent is slightly different to the real Syria Civil Defense in the sense that it's an international body that has local volunteers, whereas the real Syria Civil Defense, as you said, was established in Syria by Syrians in 1953. And of course, as areas are liberated, the real Syria Civil Defense is reclaiming its role in those areas. It had to withdraw from the terrorist-held areas or from working in the terrorist-held areas because of threats of assassinations of team members. And of course, the armed factions that overran the real Syria civil defense bases very early on in areas like Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor massacred real Syria civil defense members, kidnapped others, and forced others to work with what then became the White Helmet groups. And now in Eastern Ghouta, for example, the real Syria Civil Defense is the organization that is helping the rebuilding, the restoration of services, so water and electricity to the area so that people can return.
Yes.
And you know, this is something which is never talked about in Western media. I mean, their existence is completely erased, just as, for example, the White Helmets with their Oscar-nominated and Oscar-winning movies, The Last Men in Aleppo, It basically completely erased the existence of Nusra Front, Nur al-Din Zinki, all of these up to 50 splinter brigades from the more extremist terrorist groups. It erased them from existence. They didn't exist. The only villains in the last men of Aleppo, of course, was the Syrian government, and its Russian and Iranian and Hezbollah allies.
Yeah. Well, of course, so nothing's really official until George Clooney has made a movie about it.
So that we can. Well, in that case, no, it's not official yet, because I think he still seems to be sort of vacillating on that one. But yeah, this is another point, Phil, is that, Israel, that is perfectly happy and has no conscience over shooting a Palestinian medic in the back or killing children in Gaza, is here offering food and drink to the so-called white helmets and the militants who left with them. I mean, that's a very clear indication of Israel's involvement with this group and with, of course, the entire regime change campaign in Syria. And the very fact that this organization, which claims to be neutral, to be impartial, it has made the extraordinary claim that it saved
150,000 lives. Yes, I'm sorry.
and what is extraordinary? I mean, I'm going to be writing about that this week, but we received a Freedom of Information response finally from the British government. And what this showed us is that the British government has no idea who these lives are that the white helmets have saved, because they're entirely reliant upon the white helmets and upon Mayday Rescue, which is the, I won't call it an NGO because it's funded directly by the British government, but an organization, Mayday Rescue, that was set up by James Lemessurier, who established the white helmets in 2013 and then created Mayday Rescue to act as an intermediary, so an interface between the British government and the white helmets. But basically what the British government said in its response was that it is entirely reliant upon information fed to it by Mayday Rescue via the White Helmets. So in other words, the White Helmets could make anything up and the British government would take it on as gospel and would then repeat it in its policy documents, which it has done consistently.
Vanessa, that does raise, of course, again, this fact that they are a wholly owned subsidiary, you might call them. They don't.
Yeah.
You pointed out they don't belong to any international humanitarian bodies. One of the things those kind of international bodies do is report to one another and know what they're doing and discuss ways to improve their work. This is entirely a private operation.
Yeah, exactly. And actually what I was going to say is when I interviewed the director of Syrian Arab Red Crescent in Aleppo earlier this year, he directly said to me, he said they were not a humanitarian organization. He said they worked directly with the terrorists and they were entirely reliant upon foreign funding. And he said that foreign funding came in from governments that are trying to destabilize Syria. So that came directly from the director of the Syrian Arab Red Crescent volunteer organization in Aleppo. And that was echoed by members of the Syrian Arab Red Crescent that I spoke to pretty much across Syria. Even actually, I spoke to one volunteer in Hama, and she had been working in Idlib until it became too dangerous. And she said to me, they're a joke. She said, they're not a humanitarian organization. They're actors and they're cinematographers. Yep. She said, that's it. And what they're doing is selling this humanitarian image to the West in order to camouflage the work they're doing with the terrorist groups. Mm-hmm. I mean, Syrians are now totally informed about who the White Helmets are. And that's another reason that, of course, they have to be evacuated, because were they these selfless saviors of all mankind, they would be being celebrated and being given awards by the families of the civilians they claim to have saved. But I struggle to find, well, I haven't actually yet found one civilian that has any praise of the White Helmets. It is all criticism or actual accusations. I mean, the families who were attacked in Rashdin, the evacuees from Kafraya and Fua that were attacked with a suicide bomb that was pre-planned in April 2017. And when I say it was pre-planned, there are recordings of leaders of terrorist groups explaining exactly what they were going to do. And of course, the White Helmets were present then during the attack. And they were responsible, alongside Nusra Front, for the abduction of dead and dying children that were taken from their parents and taken to Turkey. And over 40 of those children are still missing. And so from the Syrian people, who are largely ignored, of course, because they're the wrong kind of Syrians, by Western media, there are a huge number of accusations that have been levied at this group and that are, of course, not being investigated because those narratives are not being documented by the White Helmets. I mean, it's just an extraordinary closed propaganda loop that we're actually seeing.
By the way, I mean, your work and the work of former Ambassador Peter Ford, Eva Bartlett, and many others around the world now, sort of on following the work that you have done, more and more are on the scent of what the reality is. But we have a mainstream media that is, they simply want to break this down into into camps. So they, if you bring up, as an Ambassador Ford, I found this on your Twitter site, he made the point that you did, that there's no evidence about the 115,000, they refuse to actually deal with the very pointed and factual evidence that you put in front of them. They're really in a mode of trying to smear you and others. Is that true?
Well,
he said rhetorically.
I mean, it's quite, we've been through quite a smear storm for probably the last 12 months. But, you know, what is extraordinary is if you consider the fact that the number of reports fairly recently, there have been about sexual misconduct by organizations like Oxfam, like Save the Children, like, I believe, the Red Cross. There was also embezzling of funds, et cetera, et cetera, where the media jumped on board and they ran with the story with very sensationalist headlines. But the White Helmets have filmed themselves participating in atrocities committed by Al-Qaeda, Nusra Front, under any manner of sort of rebrand or moniker change. They have been filmed participating in and celebrating executions of civilians, the dismemberment of Syrian Arab army prisoners of war, the torture and public execution of Syrian Arab army prisoners of war. They've been filmed calling for the extermination of the people in Kafraya and Fua, the villages in Idlib that have recently been evacuated. James Lemessurier has himself, in an interview, admitted in 2015 that they are a sectarian organization. Mm-hmm. They're not impartial. He said it publicly. For the number of crimes that this group has actually committed, and I include within that, of course, the protectionism that they've given towards terrorist groups that are, of course, being financed either indirectly or directly by the same governments that are funding the White Helmets. This organization has committed a huge number of crimes and has been accused of committing a number of crimes against the Syrian people. But there is not one comment about those from the media organizations, except in defense of the White Helmets or in excuse of those White Helmets committing those crimes. Oh, well, it was a bad apple, or it was just one member of the White Helmets. Mm-hmm. You know, although the archives footage of White Helmets who are still armed militant members of extremist and terrorist groups is quite extraordinary. But of course, all of that has also been ignored. Now, were this to be the Syrian Arab Red Crescent or the Red Cross, we would be seeing outrage and we would be seeing an international demand for an independent inquiry. Yeah. But it is almost impossible to even get even some of the more sensible journalists within the mainstream sort of apparatus to actually touch the White Helmets. It's almost like they're a completely, as one mainstream journalist said to me in Damascus when I asked them why were they not prepared to investigate them? They said, "Oh, well, it's too controversial and it's too polarizing."
it could lead to unemployment. Well, Vanessa, you've done great work. 21st Century Wire. Your Twitter account, by the way, to me, that's my very, very, very useful. Wonderful people you reproduce there, like former Ambassador Ford and others. Yeah. Thank you very, very much for talking to us. And I think they're going to have trouble digesting this phenomenon. So we're going to have to call you back and ask you how it's going as they try to bring them home to. To their paymasters, I guess. Thank you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much, Phil. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye. Vanessa Bealey, 21st Century Wire. And she's been more than a match for the people at The Guardian and The Spectator and all the respectable places where you feel you're in the best company. Those guys, they're all having trouble, as I said, digesting this. Because they thought they were on a roll and Assad was going to be gone. After all, Obama said he must step down. And when the President of the United States tells you to step down and you're the leader of a sovereign country, you're supposed to step down. But he didn't do that. We're going to take a break, listen to some Charles Roach, and we're going to come back and talk to Otis Richmond. Round and round, passer and scene.